Welcome to the panel discussion, Uniting on the Cybersecurity Battleground, the status of cyber threat information sharing, sponsored by Looking Glass. Here's today's moderator, Sean Kelly.
Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us. My guests today are Wally Coggins, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, Mo Bland, Director, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA, Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
So in the present interconnected world, the United States government and civilian sectors are the target. And we've got to come to a place that we can start to share information, work together, and make things better. Well, let me start with you. What is the current status of cybersecurity threats and information sharing?
We're definitely seeing the situation improve as far as there's a recognition that public and private partnerships are absolutely essential to counter the non-state and state actors that are out there trying to penetrate our networks. And there's also an increased understanding that threat intelligence needs to be actionable and timely to make sure we're responding at the time that our adversaries are.
Mo, what about you from NSA? What do you think?
I'd like to start off with trying to just first kind of describe the environment. We've got, in my mind, about three or four of the big things we've got to worry about. First is scale. We have the remit of working within the Department of Defense networks and making sure that is area that is secure first. And then you're talking about scale. How do we work with the private sector as well? And then how do we push that information out? So in terms of information sharing, I think we've got the science about right. We're going to talk a lot about standards in terms of how do we pass that information. And we can do that in terms of science there. The real part now is the art. How do we get the right information to the right people at the right time? And that's the portion that we're going to have to work at the hardest right now. So in terms of where we're at right now, I think we're doing extremely well in terms of being able to pass information. In terms of for us, first is the protection of the Department of Defense networks, and then it is also ready to provide information to DHS and the FBI so they can do further on victim notification and other things that we need to do in this space.
And I appreciate for that segue. So Rex, at DHS,
yeah,
where do you guys?
So at DHS CISA, we're well positioned to be sharing with our various stakeholder communities. You know, we service not only the .gov, but critical infrastructure, general public, international communities as well. So we have a broad set of stakeholders that we serve. The challenge for us, and I think for the kind of the community in general, is that over time we've seen an increasing sophistication of some of our stakeholder community. They're looking for not just indicators, but more context. What's the narrative associated with these indicators that you're sharing? What does it mean? And how does that feed not only cybersecurity intelligence, but also the business intelligence that's impacted by the information that we're sharing? Challenge for us is to service not only those increasingly sophisticated stakeholders, but also to make sure that the rest of the community doesn't get left behind as well.
And Alan, from the civilian sector, and part of an organization that also supports the customers, but you have to look at both sides of it. What are your thoughts?
Well, I definitely agree with some of the gentlemen's comments. I would say that there's a lot of data collection going on, but really, Rex kind of touched on it just a second ago, turning data into intelligence and actually making that relevant to organizations is really a challenge. And so there's a lot of people out there claiming that they have intelligence when in fact it's really not. And I think we need to look at, improving both, how we collect information, the formats, all of that stuff, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, but really the tradecraft. So some of the expertise that these gentlemen have in their organizations really needs to kind of trickle down to the commercial sector so that we improve the commercial sector's tradecraft as well.
Yeah, so I think, Rex, and you hit on a very important point, which is there's a lot of data, right? And we could argue that there is data overload, right? How do we know what data we need to pay attention to? Rex, I look at DHS as someone who gets hit with many different sensors and a lot of different information. And what are some ways that we can start to bring that data down to a digestible piece?
Yeah, so, data overload is certainly a challenge that we're aware of and something that we're trying to tackle both ourselves and make it easier for our stakeholder communities to deal with. So in my mind, data overload has already happened. There's no, you know, there's no stopping it. You can't walk that back. What we can do is we can improve the quality and the fidelity of our data to make it easier for the consumers to filter on their end, right, for their relevancy. So we add, you know, maybe some different data fields that let them know, you know, hey, this is relevant to my sector or not relevant to my sector, so that they're able to carve off what they need to tackle rather than trying to ingest and digest everything at once.
Yeah, I'd add on to that. The context and the contextual information is the number one issue for our analysts. They're sorting through so many alerts at this time on a day-to-day basis that allowing them to prioritize and focus on the ones that really matter is absolutely critical at the analyst level.
You know, I heard someone say recently this is a billion-dollar industry, yet most organizations have had some kind of breach at some point. And I think that's alarming to when you really think about it, is we all want to do the right thing, but we're still having a hard time finding the magic formula. Mo, is there any thoughts on what is working? What do you think the bright spots are that we can build on to go in the future?
I think the bright spots in our future is basically in artificial intelligence. It's in machine learning, and that's going to help us work our way through this data overload that we just kind of worked our way through in terms of how do we work in that space. I think where we work our best is when we are able to talk with our customers and we understand the context of the information that they need to be successful. I think in terms of working with DHS, we're starting to get in that space and being able to pass information at time, at speed. But the question is, how do we get better at working at context? And that's going to be the area that we continuously have to work within. Again, I go back and think about how we defend the Department of Defense's information networks. I think we're doing that appropriately in terms of that. But that is a very close working relationship where our ability to tune to that area is precise of what we need to be able to provide them. As I go wider, that's where it becomes very hard because mm-hmm. then I am pushing data to them. They have to then take that data and then tune it to where they need to put that information at. So it'll be a constant work that we'll have to do in that space. But the key to that for us to work in this space in the future is really all about artificial intelligence and machine learning.
I want to go back to your DoD comment in a second, but Alan, artificial intelligence, to be able to use this data, it has to be classified, it has to be put in some kind of format that we can actually use it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I definitely agree that automation is a key, and artificial intelligence techniques are definitely applicable. The challenge is that just throwing a lot of data in a big database and then expecting artificial intelligence to find the needle in the haystack is not going to result in a good outcome. So you really have to look at what data you're trying to find or what intelligence you're trying to find, making sure that you've actually got the raw data to begin with, because if you're analyzing a raw set of data that may not yield the results you're looking for, then that's the artificial intelligence is not going to fix that problem. I also think that there's a common misunderstanding of those techniques and how they can help. So, for example, are you applying anomaly detection? Are you looking at pattern detection? A lot of hype in the marketplace right now around machine learning, and that term tends to be bandied about. And I think one of the key things is that very specific targeted use of machine learning techniques can actually yield good results. But you really need to be looking for the specific things you're going for.
Rex, is there an agency, I'll ask DHS because I think it'll be easier than NDI or NSA to answer. Are there organizations that are at the machine learning and artificial intelligence level yet, or are we still in a phase that we're working towards it?
So I'm sure there are. Yeah. The challenge for us is making sure that those kind of leading edge organizations and capabilities are baked back into the broader ecosystem, right? So it may be that there might be a corner case out here or over there where we've got some machine learning that's actually really doing really good things. However, I agree with Alan that I'm relatively kind of skeptical about healthily skeptical about the capabilities. I want to make sure that we see results rather before we jump all in into AI solves all our problems. But That said, you know, the ecosystem has to be ready for those kinds of capabilities. You can't just have it sitting out in a corner case by itself.
Wally and Mo, you mentioned DoD in protecting the infrastructure and the assets. But is that a model that we can really propagate against the entire federal government and across the federal and the civilian sectors, right? You mentioned that you were defending those, and I think we are doing a pretty good job, but is that a model that we can emulate or propagate across?
No, I started off saying you've got to understand the environment we're working in. It is a scale. This landscape that we're working on, this attack surface that we're looking at is enormous. So no, I don't believe that's that we can scale or use that to do it in totality. But it is where I have my remit to work and operate in, and that's why I believe that we're postured to do that. To go back into the artificial intelligence questions and machine learning, I don't think we're there now, but it is our future where we have to be postured and we're going to have to work at. What it's going to allow us to do is it's going to allow our analysts to focus in those most sophisticated threats that we're going to have to be able to work against. And that's where we want to take our analysts out of doing those things that are routine that a machine can do for them, and then focus them back on those things that are most important to them. And I go back to position of it's an art that we're going to really get down to if we're going to be able to be very successful in this place of doing information sharing. I've got to understand what are important to you from a threat perspective. Right now, I don't think I have that total perspective of what's important. I know what I see, I know what I can see out in that area, and then what I'm able to do is push out as quickly as possible this information that I do have.
Yeah, I'll just pick up on what Mo was saying, that the intelligence community, we do benefit from being a lot more isolated than the internet-facing organizations in FedCiv or the private sector. Having said that, there are really important partnerships between the intelligence community, DoD, and the private sector in FedCiv that can be leveraged to take the information that we're able to gain in classified work that's done and bring that together with where the fight's really going on in the internet-facing organizations and help them understand what the adversaries are doing, how they're doing it, and the best ways to detect that and mitigate those effects.
So Wally, on that line, what might be done to increase the sharing of cyber-related information across all those different sectors you just mentioned?
Well, one of the important things that we are working hard on is working to tear line report or right to release, where the information may come in at a high classification level, but aspects of that may be fully releasable and unclassified. So what we work to do is find the information that the defenders need to protect their networks, make that available to them while protecting sources and methods and other classified information.
And I'll stay with you, Wally, for one more question. How do we create a common language around this?
That's going to take the partnership between the analysts that are doing the defensive work and the intelligence collectors that are coming across the information that's of interest. So it can't be one group working independently from the other. They've got to come together. The intelligence collectors need to understand the threats that and the tools that the analysts and the cyber defenders are using to protect their networks, and figure out how do they get the actionable information that those folks need to do their job. You know, what are the indicators of adversary work and things like that, and make that information available, again, while protecting their sources and methods.
Mo, I see you nodding in agreement. Anything to add on that?
Yeah, I'm in total agreement there. I think from an intelligence community standpoint, we have followed the lead of the Office of Director of National Intelligence to build what we would call a cyber threat framework. And that's been kind of the common theory and framework that all of us look at that cyber threat. What we're going to have to do is how do we continue to work with the private sector to see and be able to work on that in the same vein. I think we work very well with DHS in terms of doing and making sure they've been exposed to that. I think people have taken that on and used the common lexicon in that space and then moved off of that to say, hey, these are things that are important to me inside of that same framework. But it allows us at least to start talking in a common set framework as we move forward.
No, I appreciate that. Alan, as you hear that, what comes across your mind?
Well, I think there's two important aspects. One is the technology aspects of sharing, and then there's the policy and the higher level frameworks that Mo was referring to. From a technology perspective, you know, we have emerging standards in that area, but they're not fully adopted. For example, Styx version 2 is a really fundamentally important standard for sharing cyber intelligence that is gaining momentum, but it's really early days there. And using that those technologies effectively so that market, industry, consumers can actually produce intelligence and then be consumed by other organizations. So if a vendor is producing intelligence about some of these higher level behaviors, understanding adversaries, that another organization can actually consume it without spending a significant amount of time converting it into a format that they understand. So there's focus on technology that needs to happen, but there's also the aspects of policy. Who's allowed to share? What are they allowed to share? There's regional aspects as well with respect to that. What information can be shared, not just within the United States, but Europe to other parts as well. So there's a whole lot of higher level policy that applies to sharing that is not purely a technology problem. And we need to solve both if we are to do it effectively.
Rex, final thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the common languages thing is a challenge. And to Alan's point, it's not just a technology issue. It's a cultural issue. It's an organizational issue. I think Mo made the point earlier is that, he has a variety of stakeholders that he needs to serve. I think that it has to be a community effort to develop that common lexicon, that common language. I think DHS and other organizations that have in the past kind of pushed policies without fully consulting the stakeholder communities, those efforts have not gone as well as they should. I think the more collaborative we are, the better our results.
My guest today, Wally Coggins, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Mo Bland, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA. Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. And Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly, and we are talking about uniting of the cybersecurity battleground, the status of cyber threat information sharing. Sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Looking Glass Cyber Solutions offers unified threat protection against your business's digital risk. The Looking Glass portfolio is purposefully designed to address digital risk at every stage of the cyber attack cycle. Their outside-in view of threats helps organizations determine the risks that matter most to them, not just what's trending in the news. For unrivaled visibility, response, and management of your digital business risk, visit LookingGlassCyber.com. That's LookingGlassCyber.com.
Welcome back to the panel discussion. Today we're talking about uniting of the cybersecurity battleground, the status of cyber threat information sharing, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. My guests today are Wally Coggins, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Mo Bland, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA, Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. Alan, you not only have the coolest accent, you have the easiest title to say. I am Sean Kelly, and I am your moderator today. So before we went on break, we were talking about data. Alan, how do we use data to create alerts for suspicious activity?
Well, that assumes that you actually know what suspicious activity looks like.
Good point.
So I think if you assume that you actually know what that looks like, then you have to turn that information into a set of indicators that you would then look for in your networks or external networks as well. The challenge with that is being able to define indicators that would be have low false positives and have the controls in place to actually be able to detect it. So if you assume that you have good indicators and you have controls in place to actually detect these things, then you have the possibility of getting alerts that can be actioned. The challenge with alerting is that despite your desire to have very good indicators, there will be a lot of potential noise. And it's how you post-process those alerts and refine them into actionable alerting and intelligence that is really where we need to get better at as an industry. I think one of the key things is that if you are overcome by the amount of alerting, then what happens is security teams will just switch it off. And so we need to help them refine that data into actionable alerts using automation, as we've talked about earlier, as well as potentially mature processes on top of that. So one of the things that we haven't talked about yet so far is really that automation only can get you so far, and having a process where you can actually enable human intelligence on top of it in a 24/7, 365 day model of it processing it is really key to having a mature program of intelligence delivery.
So Rex, this is right up your area.
So I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I think one of Alan's original points, though, is key, which is needing to understand what is suspicious in order to create those alerts. I'll even dig back a little bit further to that and emphasize the point that we need to get into a better culture of sharing overall. If you look back a decade ago, there was a real culture of shame associated with compromised information. Individual organizations didn't want to admit that they had been compromised. They were fearful of reputational damage, or maybe like their stock price would take a hit, or whatever the case would be. Put them in some sort of jeopardy or risk. So they didn't share the fact that they had been compromised. That very valuable information wasn't getting out to the broader community in order for it to be actioned. I think to some degree that has changed. That culture of shame has lessened. And frankly, we have the adversaries to thank for this. They've been so prolific. Everyone's been popped. And now everyone's pretty comfortable saying, I've been compromised. Here's the information that's relevant about it. But we need to make sure that that information continues to propagate. We need to make sure that organizations know how and when to share that information, and they do so in a timely manner. I think Wally mentioned it earlier. Timeliness is key. And then we can start talking about, what is relevant, what is actionable, and how do we get it into the hands of this broader kind of stakeholder community that we serve.
I just want to say that Rex will now be a keynote speaker at DEF CON this year in Las Vegas, because his public profile just went up with that community as he thanked him. But on that point, Rex, I do want to pull on a little bit. Is it that it's more acceptable, or have we just become numb?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a bit of both, and there's danger in that, right? So it's great that it's becoming a little bit more acceptable and that people are more willing to share. But, frankly, I think a lot of certainly the general public has become a bit numb to this constant news thread feed of compromise after compromise. I think everyone has been affected by it, by a compromise at some point in the recent past. And, if we become numb to it, then we stop taking action. And that's when it becomes really dangerous and the adversaries, begin taking advantage of that complacency.
What's your thoughts?
I really think Alan did a great job of kind of describing the environment that we kind of work in and some of the real challenges in this space. It is really, how do I understand what his needs are in this space? And it goes back to some of the things we talked about in the beginning, maybe making sure we have a common lexicon in terms of the way that we're going to share information and talk about the threat. But it really gets down to where I continuously talk about this art of how do I have this conversation with that specific sector of the market that we can understand exactly what those needs are. And so as we're working through, and we're going to work through the problem sets and looking at information in the same kind of way, looking for anomalies, looking for how do we look for signatures, using, in most cases, industry standards of SNORT and other tools like that to make sure we're talking about and able to share this information. But it gets down to really understanding how is his network set up, what's important to him, and I can get that information to him in a timely and relevant fashion.
Wally, something that Alan said really kind of struck me, because I think we've been talking about automation for so long, and he said, that's not the complete answer. And I've read so much that said automation, once we can get to a place of automation, we're going to be in such a better place. What are your thoughts on that?
I totally agree with what Alan said, that automation is only effective if we're dealing with high quality data. The information has to have context with it. It can't simply be, it's a bad IP address block. There has to be context with what's the reason that it's bad, to alert the analyst to, you know, the actions that they should take, because the noise is so great that they need that help. Automation can help sort through some of the routine alerts and things like that and focus them on the right things, but it all starts with quality data and getting to some of the things that Mo was getting at, where we have a common lexicon, what good context means with indicators of compromise and things like that, so the analysts do get the information they need and know what they're looking at when they do get alerts.
You know, we've talked about data quality a lot so far today. And so how do we use frameworks, data analytics, business intelligence to facilitate informed decision-making due to having more accurate picture of activity? I mean, we talked about it, but once we have it, then how are we going to use it? Alan?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. The MITRE ATT&CK framework is something that's getting a lot of attention in both government as well as industry, and quite rightly so. It really helps formulate how we talk about attacks and threats in particular, and put a structure around both how we talk about intelligence, how we model intelligence, but also then where are our gaps and our controls and our defenses. So you can use the ATT&CK framework to really help identify where your defensive posture is lacking, potentially where it needs attention. You can also use it to focus and prioritize. So that is just one example of an ATT&CK, you know, framework that can be really helpful. And you know, I know that you know, they are looking at providing abilities to provide feedback on that across the industry. So MITRE are looking at ways to collect information in an anonymous way that helps them refine that ATT&CK framework and the information that's provided through it, so that it can then enrich and improve the actual information, and then that information it helps everybody in the industry. So that's just one example. You know, there are others.
Well, as soon as he said the MITRE framework, you started nodding in agreement. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It becomes kind of the baseline of where all of us talk about. I've always believed that the only way you get to being able to defend yourself in this area is to have a common lexicon of how you talk about the threat. Truth in advertising, I'm a retired military officer, and as a battalion S2 in Korea, I made sure my battalion commander talked about the threat in a certain way that he knew it was going to come to him in a certain way. And that's what the MITRE threat ATT&CK framework does. It allows me to talk about the threat from cradle to grave, in my estimation. It begins at the preparation stage, and it goes all the way into what the actual deployment of malware looks like. And it gives all of us that common threat to talk about the threat and move forward.
Well,
yeah, one of the things that we do need to appreciate is there are different mission sets, use cases for the threat intelligence that's collected. You have strategic decision makers that simply need to know what our adversaries are doing and why, so they can develop policies and strategies to counter those situations. And then you have the cyber defenders that need highly technical information to deploy their tools and indicators and malware signature detection capabilities to detect that activity. So those models give us the ability to have those conversations, whether they're for the strategic decision makers or the network defenders.
Rex?
Yeah, so I think it really gets back to what we were talking about earlier about it needs to be a community effort, and that's exactly what I think ATT&CK has been. Is, you know, it's been community driven. It's something that we've adopted within CISA, within the threat analysis shop. You know, but to Wally's point, I mean, there are circumstances where, for whatever reason, that, you know, broadly accepted framework isn't going to be you know, optimized, right? So I know NSA uses the NTCTF. You know, which is similar to ATT&CK, but it's different in key ways that better enable their mission space. You know, but having that community-driven, community acceptance of a framework, I think, is absolutely key. So that, you know, to Mo's point earlier, we're speaking out of a common language, common lexicon.
If I can just hold, we have that framework, but it was based off of what ODNI kind of drove in terms of a cyber threat framework. And that cyber threat framework was also based on the MITRE attack framework model. So I, again, if you start looking at how the community is looking at these problems, that we're all starting to converge in the same area. But there still has to be work to be done. There still has to be work to be done in terms of sticks and taxi in terms of, hey, these are the data models that are acceptable and we're going to share information through. But I think we're starting to get there. The question is, how do we now have a forcing function to cause us all to get there? Because collectively, we're starting to figure out only way we survive in this area is to work together.
So before I ask the next question, I'll ask you just to spell out that framework, because people listening heard A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and I want to make sure that they know what that is.
So STIGS is the Structured Threat Information Expression, and then TAXI is the Trusted Automation Exchange of Indicator and Information.
All right, thank you very much. So the forcing function, you know, when I have a lot of people come on the show, one of the things is we talk about those forcing functions. Is this something that we can solve? And maybe Lucas says, not to put you on the spot, is this something we can solve, or do we need help? Do we need an enaction of a law or something to help with a forcing function? Do we need some assistance? Or can this be something that the communities come together, private, public, and all that? Oh, Alan, go ahead.
So one of the things that the OASIS standards organization that is helping lead STIGS and TAXI standardization for version 2 now, they've spent a lot of time trying to introduce a certification program around organizations who claim that they implement STIGS and TAXI. One of the challenges with the earlier version of those standards was that it was too easy for people to say, yep, I support it. And frankly, it meant nothing. It was a chat box when you came to integrate vendor X product with another product. It wouldn't work. And so OASIS has spent a lot of time introducing a certification program where organizations can actually verify not just that they support it, but support it in industry standard ways at expected behaviors. So if you are a vendor who produces a tip or a threat intelligence feed or a firewall or any other type of security infrastructure that is relevant to use STIGS, then there's an expected way to either produce or consume intelligence, and there's a way to actually verify it. And then once you receive that certification, that information is then made available publicly so that consuming organizations who are looking to buy products can actually say, hey, vendor X supports this persona for STIGS and TAXI, and that therefore is a mark of quality. So it's not just focus on standards, but also how standards actually are implemented in a more interoperable way.
And this is both on the private and the public side?
Yes, it's open to all.
How would we implement that? How would we bring that to the marketplace that people would want to subscribe to that?
So OASIS have actually launched, it's called STIGS Preferred. It's if you go to, I forget the exact URL, but I'm sure we can follow
we'll
that up.
We'll get it, we'll put it in the
portal. But there's a portal that's already open publicly. You can download all of the documents about what it requires in terms of what you need to do to implement interoperability from a STIGS and TAXI perspective, and also all of the test results. So if you're an organization that has gone through the certification program, all of your test results will be available for download. So the intention is to be completely transparent in terms of people say, okay, I support STIGS for a firewall, then their information is actually available for organizations to consider.
So request for comments, RFCs, right? Those are public standards that we know about, and those are the way different protocols work. And those are some of the best tools of our adversaries, where they understand the rules. Could this also be used for bad as well as good?
Well,
Agree.
So any data can be used both positively and negatively. And the more information you share, the outcome of that could be for a negative purpose, if you will. You're saying bad actor, but it could be for other purposes that are maybe not considered malicious, but they're used not as intended. I think adversaries learn from each other. They are very good at sharing. If you look at the forums that they share, how to construct malware, how they exchange information to go after their adversary or go after their targets. they're very effective at it. What we need to realize is that, that the information that we share needs to be protected so that they can then not use it to their advantage.
All right, thank you. My guests today are Wally Cogley, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Mo Bland, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA, Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I am your moderator, and Sean Kelly. We are talking about Uniting of Cybersecurity Battleground, the status of cyber threat information sharing, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Looking Glass Cyber Solutions offers unified threat protection against your business's digital risk. The Looking Glass portfolio is purposefully designed to address digital risk at every stage of the cyber attack cycle. Their outside-in view of threats helps organizations determine the risks that matter most to them, not just what's trending in the news. For unrivaled visibility, response, and management of your digital business risk, visit LookingGlassCyber.com. That's LookingGlassCyber.com.
Welcome back to the panel discussion of Uniting of the Cybersecurity Battleground, the status of cyber threat information sharing, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. My guests today are Wally Coggins, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, Mo Bland, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA, Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, and Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly. So, gentlemen, before we went on break, we were talking about data, data security, and how do we use this data. So how do we create information sharing platforms that facilitate greater information sharing on cyber threats? Alan.
Well, I think the most obvious one is by adopting standards wholeheartedly. I think stakes and taxis have been mentioned multiple times now. I think that's a great place to start. We need to get everybody using standards. But that's where it starts. It's really how do we then build upon that standard exchange format to standardize best practices? How do organizations collect information, making sure that they understand best practices so that they can apply it to their capabilities, and also generally improve the quality of intelligence? So how can they make sure that when they do share intelligence, that downstream consumers are actually going to find value in it? And so we need to go far beyond sticks and taxi and look at best practices for intelligence collection and distribution.
Rex, it's got to be something that you guys are looking at and trying to figure out.
It is. And before we broke, we were talking about what is that forcing function? What is the event or the method by which we make sure that we maximize the adoption? I think from our perspective, there was some discussion about, is there a law that gets enacted? In my mind, that's a last resort sort of thing. What we want is what Alan is describing, which is, we create a scenario, a framework, a platform that is so compelling that there is widespread voluntary adoption, and we all come together on the same page, as willing participants rather than being kind of forced to the same table. In that case, I think we maximize the advantages and the value that we get out of that commonality.
Mo?
I think we really have framed the discussion properly. We are all focused in on the same thing, having a common lexicon in terms of how we talk about the threat, using the same protocol, sticks and taxi to share information. And then Wally really touched on a really big important piece that we've got to realize as we're pushing out that information, especially from an intelligence community standpoint. We're trying to get that information down to multiple layers, starting off with decision makers, senior policy makers, getting down to the technical aspects that you talked about, Wally, in terms of those who are on the network defender side of the house, and then all the way down, pushing it further down to the unclassified sector for us, down to people in Allen's area there. So it becomes really tough for us to do that. One of the things that NSA lacks, and that's fine in terms of the way the laws are currently structured, I can't share that information directly with Allen's company. I would have to go through DHS or through FBI to get that information all the way down to that level. So right now, that's the way we have to operate. We understand that, and that's the framework that we operate within.
Wally?
I'll start by wholeheartedly agreeing with my panel member colleagues. Getting the common lexicon and standards is the first step, and the interoperable systems that can exchange the information as rapidly as possible. With things like Styx and Taxi, they do provide a really good format for the data exchanges, the technical exchanges of the information. I think we need to take them a step further and get to the standards for what is good contextual information to be included when those data exchanges are made. Also, there needs to be a maturing of important aspects of this, which are some of the real challenging areas. The IC needs to protect sources and methods, so we need to get better at doing tear line, right to release reporting. There are also significant legal constraints and safeguarding of civil liberties and privacy issues that need to be addressed. So we need to walk through those as well. But again, to achieve the goals as has been laid out here, to get that information to the folks that need it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the struggle. And Rex, probably go to you from this from a DHS standpoint, is that really that easy to do? I mean, you're getting data from a lot of places, and then you need to get it out to a very diverse audience. Mm-hmm. And it has to happen quickly.
Yeah.
And so how can we start to move forward in that kind of fashion?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not easy to do.
No.
It's a huge challenge, and it's probably one of the key challenges that we face right now. Frankly, I think it's a multifaceted issue. I think there are two ways in which we address it. One is through technology. We've talked a lot about, some of the common lexicon, common platform, common frameworks. Once we're all speaking the same language, you remove the cost of translation across stakeholder communities, right? So if NSA is communicating to us in the same way that we're going to communicate to our final stakeholders, we're able to move that information a heck of a lot faster. This isn't exciting, but frankly, it's a process issue. Okay. To Wally's point, to Mo's point, getting stuff downgraded from classified level to a point where it flows through us and out to our various stakeholder communities, that there is a lot of kind of human aspects to that. And it's a process, and it takes some time right now. And the faster that we can flow through that process, the faster we can get pretty valuable information out to the folks that really need it.
Alan?
Yeah, I mean, timeliness and getting data out, it goes in the opposite direction of accuracy oftentimes. If you want accurate information, sometimes you want to have multiple sources corroborating the information. You want to assess the sources of that information so that you know that it can be acted on quickly. And the desire to get information out, oftentimes some of those things may be compromised. And that is a challenge because you really need to get the information out, but if you want it to be accurate, you may actually need to wait for additional sources or additional vetting, either machine or human, before you can then distribute it downstream. And so I think the better we are at being able to find accurate information and be able to vet it automatically from multiple sources quickly, then you'll be able to then distribute it more quickly to a downstream consumer who can act on it with trust.
Rex, you want to add something?
Yeah, so I mean, AIS is a great example of what you're describing, Alan. So this is a program, a platform that we stood up a number of years ago to push indicators out to basically the world. But the emphasis was on volume and velocity, right? There's no human or very little human interaction with those indicators. They are going out as fast as possible, machine to machine. One of the critiques that we've seen kind of ramp up in recent months and years is that, the fidelity, the quality of these indicators isn't as high as some of our stakeholder communities would want. Frankly, we're getting that feedback from our more sophisticated stakeholders. Alan, to your point, sometimes you need to move fast.
Okay.
And then there are other times where you want to take your time and you want to increase the context, the fidelity, the data quality. And frankly, I think there's a time and a place for both. But understanding what you're consuming on the consumer end, am I getting a feed that is high volume, high velocity, where I need to know that I can't necessarily inherently trust that everything that I see in this feed is going to be something that I need to pay attention to, relevancy or actionability? Or am I consuming a feed that is highly vetted, I know that everything that comes through here is relevant to me, and anything that I see a hit on from this feed, I need to take immediate action in. I need to prepare to work over the weekend. You know, that kind of understanding on the consumer end is absolutely critical.
Mo, though you've mentioned it's a scale. It's all about scale, and it's a closed network. But are there some lessons learned that you can take from NSA that could be applied to that problem?
This is really tough because it starts off with scale. Mm-hmm. I know my customer. I know their networks. I am intricately involved with those networks. So that becomes the difference of, I think, where we have to work at. I think we have the science right, and that is we can quickly pass information through AIS. And that's where I think the science is right for us to do that. The hard part, and the part we're going to have to really work on, and the part that's going to make us successful, is what I call the art part now. It is now, how do I tailor that information and make sure it gets to the right customer in the right format that they need it. Until we can do that, until we can have that type of discussion, it is very, very hard. And that's really, you know, dependent on what the situation is. We have talked about data overload, and that's why you have the overload, because we just have information that just quickly goes out and out and out. And so the network defender gets all that information, and they're having to make a decision. Wow, what's important to me, what's not? And the real question now is, we've got all those things down. Now, how do we go back and have this greater discussion about what's important to you, what do you need, and who's the right person to pass that information to them?
Well, yeah, I mean, Mo brings a good point up. I mean, it's making sure you have, everybody did. It's making sure you have the right information. But we've got to find some way. You know, there's got to be some way to start to tackle this and get across the information needs to get out all the way down to Alan, right? What are your thoughts on what Mo just said?
I couldn't agree more. For me, it all boils down to partnerships, partnerships within the government, partnerships between the government and the private sector, figuring out how to build those relationships, build those data exchanges based on the shared situational awareness where no one organization anywhere in government or the private sector has a perfect view of the world. But when you begin to bring them together, that's when you improve your picture of what the adversaries are doing, how they're doing that. Bringing the different perspectives together, getting the information together, finding the tools to do that, and the sharing arrangements to make that happen. They're not always natural. Getting the private sector to bring forward information that could have reputational effects or even financial effects is challenging. Getting the government to share highly classified information is also challenging. But we need to find that middle ground where we do get the information that the end users need to do their jobs and make it happen.
So let's go with the premise that we get good at intelligence sharing. We get there. How do we respond to that point? And how do we respond together? Alan, let me start with you.
If I understand your questions correctly, you know, if we assume that we are perfect at intelligence sharing.
We're there. We've arrived at what we're talking. We've got there over the last 56 minutes.
Yeah, awesome. well, I would say the true measure of success of that would actually be, are we making it so hard for adversaries in time, expertise, and cost to actually succeed at their objectives that they go somewhere else? Because they're not going to stop. This is a marathon, it's not a sprint. And so whatever we do to kind of make it harder, they're going to figure out or try to figure out how to go around that. And so we need to be thinking about the long game and ultimately slowing the progress of that adversary down. And that's using intelligence, but also figuring out how intelligence can inform what do you respond to the adversary with so that you can slow down, disrupt, potentially delay their attacks. Because if they're a determined adversary, well-funded, whether that's cyber criminals or state actors, the key point is they're not just going to go away with simple actions. So you need to be thinking about the long-term play and the long-term playbook of response. And that includes what do you do about when you detect threats and how you delay them.
Rex?
Yeah, so I'm with Alan. You know, ultimately, the goal of cyber threat intelligence is to raise the cost of operations to the adversary. You know, I think When you look at our adversary populations, there's a couple different strata. You know, if the less sophisticated the adversary, the more likely you are to actually stop them. But to Alan's point, the more sophisticated they are, you're basically trying to slow them down or send them elsewhere. I think when we get to that, you know, that kind of, you know, promised land of purpose, you know, perfect information sharing, you know, what we're talking, we need to be talking about two different kind of axes. You know, one is the quality of the information, making sure that we are giving everything that a defender needs in order to, you know, effectively defend their environment. But then we need to look at the coverage of our stakeholder communities. Are we reaching out to everyone that we need to reach out to? And frankly, I mean, I think that's as big of a challenge, if not a larger challenge, than a lot of what we've been talking about today in terms of data quality. There are a small, relatively small subset of sophisticated consumers of cyber threat intelligence, right? Active consumers of cyber threat intelligence. There's a larger set of passive consumers, you know, that get it through the various technologies that they've implemented within their environment. But then there is even a larger set of kind of mom and pop shops, individuals, people who don't have the deployed technology or the sophistication to consume that intelligence. Reaching out to them is that last mile, and it's going to be a long one for our industry.
Gentlemen, I think we could talk about this topic all day, but I want to thank you all. I'd like to thank today's guest, Wally Coggins, Director of IC Security Coordination Center in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Mo Bland, Deputy Chief of Cybersecurity Operations at NSA, Rex Booth, Chief of Cyber Threat and Risk Analysis at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly, and you are listening to Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. For more information and discussion, visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search CyberChat. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the panel discussion, Uniting on the Cybersecurity Battleground, the Status of Cyber Threat Information Sharing, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.